from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting on location. Today, we're going to talk about how the oils in your diet could actually slow the spread and growth of breast cancer. We search the world literature every day for quality peer-reviewed studies done at respected institutions, but unfortunately not making it into the mainstream media for whatever reason. We present it. And these are matter of record, meaning it's not speculation, it's not hearsay, it's not something that's not based upon good science. So we're going to cover that. But more than anything today, we're going to cover the environment. I've invited Professor Paul Beckwith from Ottawa. He is a physicist, an engineer, and a research fellow, doctoral fellow, in the Laboratory of Paleoclimatology and Climatology at the University of Ottawa. He teaches there on climate sciences. So we're going to ask him about how bad is it, and the fact that a careful review of the IPCC report and updates on the status of global climate change. So here's what you can expect today. A really insightful, scholarly look at how bad is it. With what certainty can we reasonably predict that things are going to get so bad that where you're living now, you will not be able to. Now remember, just 2 weeks ago, if you told people in Northern Panhandle who'd been there for decades, generations, without a problem, you will not be able to live here in the future, they would have said, that's just wrong. But it's right. It happened. Complete decimation of communities. Everything destroyed. Would you rebuild knowing that that's the new norm? 1 mile an hour under a Category 5. They'd never been hit with a Category 5. We were 1 mile an hour under a Category 5 in Southwest Florida, where my animal sanctuary is. One mile per hour, otherwise Category 5. 156 mile an hour winds. So, can we be honest at the federal level? The President of the United States is doing something unique now, and he is pro-coal, but so is Australia. So both Australia and President Trump and his cabinet are rejecting the dire predictions of the IPCC report. In fact, they're declaring war on the Terra. So we'll take a look at Dr. Gideon Polva from Countercurrents on a topic that is not discussed very often or at all. And then, time permitting, I want to go to part three of the continuation of the left's abandonment of liberalism and the hypocrisy of their stands. Now, for those of us who grew up, my mother was liberal. She was a liberal Democrat. And she instilled in me the virtues of both the conservative respect for community, family, and honesty, manners, ethics, character. All those came from my mother. In her own very gentle way, she was very soft-spoken. So she saw a bridge that connected the best of the conservative values and the best of the liberal values. And that's why I came to New York City. That was a very motivating factor. Now take a look at what the Democrats have become. They are not supporting the true virtues of FDR's liberalism. As a result, the left has abandoned them. The corporate left has abandoned them. And those of us who supported that have moved on into progressivism, where we're no longer going to support either party. We will support honest third-party candidates seeking to correct the terrible situation that these two have put us into. So one of the people who is standing up and speaking out is Brendan O'Neill. He is one He's one formidable person. I've seen him in debates. I don't agree with everything he says, but a lot of it I think we need to listen to. And then I posted a Young Turks, "Hey, cops treat black children as children instead of criminals." There's this post I put on my Facebook today of a young 12-year-old boy. He's committed no crimes. He's with his aunt. They're in a shopping mall, and the police stop him and run a background check on him. But in the process, they're holding him, physically restraining him. The aunt is polite, but saying, you know, you have no right to be doing this. And then she is arrested. He's arrested. This is so common in the United States today. Is that all police? Absolutely not. But my belief is that those cops who would not do that, who would not look at a black or Latino or any other person, a minority, as an enemy of the state, and therefore you can treat them as you want, you should be calling these people out. You should be calling them out in your precinct. You should be calling these hyper-steroid SWAT team idiots out. You should be really, really in their face. I don't see it. And I have a lot of cop friends. I don't see it. So if the good ones who do not overreact, do not stand up and call out the corrupt shamelessly, completely off-base ones who are acting out, then you're going to end up having the entire police in America stained. If that's what you want, you're going to get it. That's the unintended consequences of not having the courage. We're talking about courage. Courage to stand up against the corruption, malfeasance, inappropriate behavior within your own ranks. We'll hear that segment. But we always start with the latest on health and healing. And today, there's a new study out from the University of Nebraska, and it talks about the omega-3 fatty acids, such as those typically contained in fish oil. And those can help suppress the growth and spread of breast cancer cells, at least in this laboratory experiment. And this is according to a new study published in the peer-reviewed journal Clinical and Experimental Metastases, which is published to the oncologists, mainly in the United States. Well, according to the lead author from their University of Nebraska Medical Center, fatty acids stop further and delayed tumors from forming and block the cancer cells from spreading to other organs. And the researchers speculate that this might be because of the way in which omega-3 fatty acids support the body's immune and anti-inflammatory systems. That's terrific. Here's what I would add. You're talking about a fatty acid. The fatty acid from fish and the fatty acid from avocados, walnuts, flaxseed, hemp seed are used the same in the body. It depends upon the percentage of the DHA and EPAs. So I would suggest they now do the same thing, same study, with the vegan source of the omega-3 fatty acids, because that's sustainable. If for no other reason, the fish are not. So, but the takeaway message is take your omega-3 fatty acids and help prevent breast cancer. And then if you do have breast cancer, it helps stop the spread of it in your body. And that's important. University of Michigan. Nutrition has a greater impact on bone strength than exercise. Well, historically, we've been led to believe that every time you apply pressure to your major bones, that increases the bone capacity to create new cells within it and strengthening, hardening the bone. Well, one question that scientists and fitness experts alike would love to answer is that true? And University of Michigan researchers looked at mineral supplementation and exercise in this experiment and found surprising results. Nutrition had a greater impact on bone mass and strength than exercise. Further, even after exercise training stopped, the bone mass continued in gain as long as they ate a multi-supplemental diet. So, kale, seaweeds, sesame seeds, tahini, all the good sources of calcium, and there are a lot of them, you can get your bones stronger and healthier. From the Federal University of Minas Gerais in Brazil, mindfulness-based program can help reduce stress in infertile women. This was an 8-week mindfulness-based program, and it was effective for reducing stress and depressive symptoms while increasing general well-being in this study. This was published in Stress and Health, and they took infertile women who had underwent a program which included meditation and relaxation and guided imagery, and they found that those who did this on a regular basis were able to substantially improve the quality of their life, their mental attitude. And why? Because infertile women are often overwhelmed with chronic stress and are at an increased risk of depression. So this mindful meditation for women wanting to become fertile but were not able to, this could help them reduce the stress and hence depression. And from a Wanli University in China, a compound found in brown algae, that's a really nutritious algae, and sea cucumber were able to inhibit the formation of skin cancer and actually promote suicide in the cancer cells. That's important. So the takeaway message is we all want to protect ourselves against skin cancer. So vitamin D3 helps, vitamin C helps, quercetin helps, but now we've got servings of brown seaweed, which are very easy to get. That can help as well, including with melanoma. Now, what seaweeds? Let me make it a little easier for you. Kombu, C-O-M-B-U. It's an excellent source of iodine and fucoidin, and it promotes thyroid function. For those of you who have an underactive thyroid, it can help bring up your metabolism. It's full of nutrients that can improve organ function, immunity, and muscle agility, and general wellness. And wakame, W-A-K-A-M-E. It also contains the fucoidin, and contains also high qualities of fiber. It's good for constipation, helps you lose weight, and it contains a substance that prevents fat accumulation in the cells. So that's good. Also, the number of veterans affairs facilities offering acupuncture is growing rapidly. And we should reach out to the president and members of Congress, especially your own legislators, House members and senators, as well as the director of the Veterans Administration, and suggest that every single veterans hospital offer acupuncture, offer intravenous vitamins, and if they need any science, we have all the science. It's in their own library of medicine, but I don't expect them to do the homework. We will. And a plant-based diet. And we have over 1,000 studies from PubMed showing you the benefit. I've helped a lot of veterans get their health back. Hundreds and hundreds. In fact, in about 3 months, I'm going to be taking 10 veterans into a home that I built. I'm interviewing sergeant majors. These are the kind of drill instructors. You need someone to help be there every day, to answer questions, to keep them in line, because you've got a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder. You need a humanistic psychologist. You need a dietitian. You need a lot of people on staff just to help people function. And you need animals for the animal care. You need a green environment for them to bond with nature. A whole lot go into this formula, but if all goes well, at the end of a year, these people will be happy, healthy, over their post-traumatic stress. Their body, if they suffer from an exposure to depleted uranium, help cleanse that out and get them back with their families where they belong and back into the society that they deserve. So then I'll share that with everyone, and hopefully other people will be motivated to put them in every community in America or Canada or other countries that have vets. In any case, this just showed that acupuncture works. Well, of course it works, but there's a whole bureaucracy to get through. And so the more people say there's good science from PubMed showing acupuncture is great, so why don't you get it into every facility, but then we can get meditation in there, get on their diet, get some juices, even simple juices, you know, like a vegetable juice, you know, orange juice, fresh made, grapefruit juice, things that don't cause their heads to explode. Because in bureaucracies, anything that is simple and easy confuses them. They're used to pushing papers and not questioning anything. So we'll give them a whole diet. We'll make everything out for them and make it easy. We'll make it so even in an institution with 1,000 people that they have to prepare for, they can do it without a problem. Also, there was a meta, which means many, analysis confirms that vitamin D has a protective effect against colds and flu. This is from Queen Mary University in London. And while the pharmaceutical industry is bent on pushing pills and inoculations as the only way to prevent colds and flu each season, turns out the secret to keeping illness at bay has been in front of us all along, vitamin D. It's colloquially known as the sunshine vitamin, and it's just has been proven to help fight respiratory infections, colds, and flu. And for people who are vitamin D deficient, taking a supplement can help reduce the risk of infection by up to 50%. And that's in the scientific literature. So it's not hearsay. But of course, there's no money being spent on this. And so as a result, everyone gets their injections. Let me just give you one heads up. I don't have time to do it, but I'm responding in an article I'm writing about all these so-called experts saying, just get your damn flu shot. Remember that doctor on NBC said that? Well, they're wrong. And not only are they wrong, they're dangerously wrong. Because getting a flu shot for some people can cause paralysis and other people death. But they say, but look at the enormous number of people coming down with the flu. Go to the CDC's own website, don't take my word for this, and read carefully the entirety of it, and you'll see that they have combined pneumonia, which is 95% of the infections and deaths, with the flu. They're two completely separate microorganisms, and a flu shot will not protect you from pneumonia, but the advice we give does. In 1 year, for example, 1 year that they said 36,000 people died of the flu, it was only under 1,000. The rest died of pneumonia. So they're lying about everything. But then again, the CDC doesn't know how to tell the truth. It's a military organization, by the way. You may not be aware of that. It is. Oh, by the way, some good news for those suffering or know someone suffering from sickle cell anemia. The disease can be naturally affected with the bleeding heart herb. This is from the Owolabo University in Nigeria. And I'll spell this so that you get it right. Bleeding, B-L-E-E-D-I-N-G, heart, H-E-A-R-T, herb. That's what they found. It's a leaf extract in treating sickle cell disease. I thought that was important, just one of the different remedies. And this was published in the European Journal of Medicinal Plants. The researchers collect the leaves of this particular species. And let me give you the species, C, period, P-O-L-Y, poly, C-E-P-H-A-L-L-U-M. And then they dried them and they macerated them into menthol. For 3 days, and then the menthol extract was further divided into various solvents like hexane and water, and then they used it. And so that it had a substantial inhibitory and reversal effect. So that's what they did with sickle cell anemia. So the herb was shown to prevent and reverse sickling. And pain in sickle cell disease is due to the sickling. That sickling is coming together, the S-I-C-K-L-I-N-G, of red blood cells. And the anti-sickling effects of this herb, this leaf extract were dose-dependent and purification greatly enhanced the reversal activity. So that's important, something we didn't know today. Now we do. And finally, there are amazing benefits with ginseng. I remember I was going to do a debate back in the early 1970s. It was on, I think, Good Morning New York. And the doctor said that there was no benefit to ginseng. There was no science proving it worked. It was just an expensive, worthless nostrum. I had done some homework before the debate, and I said, well, I found 5,000 studies in peer-reviewed literature that ginseng works on all these different conditions. And the person says, well, where'd you find that literature? I said, this is from the Chinese Academy of Medicine and the Japanese National Academy of Sciences. They're what would be equivalent to our National Academy of Sciences. The fact that you're not reading other people's important scientific literature, cultures that have been using it for thousands of years, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's just your knowledge of it doesn't exist. You're giving your opinion, I'm giving the science. It's that simple. That happens all the time. In any case, the science is overwhelming. So just understand that this is one unique herb. And from a traditional Chinese medicine perspective, the powerful herb is thought to balance both yin and yang. And you can also find evidence that ginseng benefits weight loss, reduces inflammation, improves brain function, increases energy, boosts immunity, lowers blood sugar. Other health benefits include treating erectile dysfunction, as good for men as that, preventing and treating cancer, helping with menopausal symptoms, improving quality of life overall. And there are 11 species of ginseng, but the most popular types include the Asian ginseng, which is Panax, and the American ginseng, which is a form of Panax. So what does it do? It improves mood and reduces stress. And these are based upon scientific studies. It improves brain function, especially in Alzheimer's. And it lowers inflammation from all forms of inflammation in the body. And it increases energy substantially. It fights fatigue. And it can actually be a part of a program to treat cancer because it's a strong anti-inflammatory and can inhibit tumor growth. And I've seen many articles in scientific literature. For example, the Asian Journal of Andrology, they tested Korean red ginseng daily, found it to be effective in the treatment of erectile dysfunction. Lowers your blood sugar. That's good for diabetics. Boosts your immune system, which everyone benefits. And you just don't have the side effects. That's the latest in health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. We're going to go in just a second to part three of the left's abandonment of liberalism and the hypocrisy by which they do it. I just want to share a few thoughts. Right now, this is a question, and I'll be happy to take answers after this audio clip. And our talkback number is 888-874-4888. I have two issues I'd like to address that no one is touching. One, we have a clip. And I'm going to ask Jesse or Eric in New York or Alex in New York to find it. It's a clip from the Young Turks of an open-air slave market. Maybe it's CNN. In any case, it's not a long clip, but it shows them selling Africans in Libya with no one interfering every day. And the cost of you could buy a young, strong male to use as a slave for $400. I think someone bought three of them for $800. And you can buy women as a sex slave or as a servant. The return of slavery. No one's questioning it. No one's stopping it. We got the clip. No one's questioning it. No one's stopping it. There were two human beings on this planet who caused this to happen. Barack Obama. Now, isn't there some irony there? I can't be the only person who sees this. But we live in such denialism that we double down on stupid. And Hillary Clinton. Remember, she cackled. We came, we conquered, he died. He died because Sarkozy had the French troops there. They were watching him by satellite. They saw his motorcade leaving the country, and they got him, and he was sodomized with swords and knives. A slow death. No one's apologized for the absolute carnage that has occurred with tens of thousands of deaths, slavery being reintroduced, and everything that was the finest of the 54 countries in Africa being completely destroyed. It would be like going to Paris and leveling it, completely leveling it with bombs, and then taking no responsibility at all. Except this wasn't in the European nation, this was Africa. And I guess whatever we want to do in Africa, because of how racist we are, is okay. It's not okay with me. And it's not okay that the Democrats then, and all the women who voted for her, we want a woman. Where's the Me Too movement for all the women right now who are being beheaded, beaten in Saudi Arabia? Why don't we have a national boycott to boycott all products from Saudi Arabia? And what about, and then calling them out? Why won't we do that? Why do we deny? And I'm not going to any other country. I'm not going to Syria. I could. To Honduras, Hillary Clinton's coup there. I could. The killing of all the union leaders, the liberal union leaders, and the Marxists there. I could. I could take you around the world and show you how much blood is dripping on the hands of the Clintons and Obama. But I won't. Just Libya. Just slavery. Just today, not a word about it. No responsibility, no one doing a commentary, no those idiots, and I'm calling them idiots on CNN. They're an embarrassment, everything that journalism should be, but they're not real journalists, nor is anyone over on that clown station, MSNBC. In any case, I want to hear from you. That's number one. Number two, how is it that now Saudi Arabia has been caught? They have videos of 15, and they were identified, 15 national security people from Saudi Arabia coming out on two separate planes. They go directly over. Then the reporter goes in from the Washington Post, who's also from Saudi Arabia. And then they kill him, cut him up into pieces, and then get him out. And you don't see him exiting. His fiancée was there. And all the video shows he didn't exit. And then they lied about it. Of course they're going to lie about it. And now we find out this morning that he was alive when they were butchering him, when they were dismembering his body. He wasn't even dead. Now, here's the point that I was listening to some of the different commentaries, both from the left and right, and both seemed to come to the same conclusion. Well, that wasn't a good thing they did, but let's take whatever excuse they give, because after all, there are jobs and a $100 billion contract at stake. Wow. Let's just show him that he should never do that again. Bad boy. Bad boy. Wow. No. He's a Hitler. He is evil. He is a genocidalist. Go to Yemen. Oh, we can't talk about Yemen because we're part of that. And jobs, 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 jobs. We don't want to give anyone the idea that how they're making their money in the defense industry should give them a moment pause of morality. And as a result, it's all about the jobs. Nobody gives a damn about the starving children in Yemen. And only today did the Washington Post finally raise the question about, isn't Saudi Arabia somehow connected with Yemen and the United States, and haven't we been supporting him with all the weapons, and aren't the people dying in Yemen dying because of America and its complicit allies? Yeah. So, Washington Post, you clowns, you just found out Yemen is a bad story today, and America is complicit today? Wow. Where have you been for 3 years? I'll tell you, there should be zero belief and tolerance of any of these journalists in the United States, starting with the New York Times. Anyway, I want to hear your point of view. We're going to play that clip right now on Slavery Market.
A man addressing an unseen crowd. Big, strong boys for farm work, he says. 400. 700. 700. 800. The numbers roll in. These men are sold for 1,200 Libyan pounds, $400 apiece.
This footage, obtained by CNN, is a scene from a modern-day slave auction in Libya, where three men were sold for the equivalent of $800. These men are migrants who fled war-torn and harsh conditions in their home countries to seek a better life in Europe by way of Libya. Their stories are not unique. Every year, tens of thousands of people arrive in Libya, either escaping conflict in sub-Saharan Africa or seeking better economic opportunities just across the Mediterranean. The UN estimates that there are 700,000 migrants currently living in Libya. This influx of migrants has led to a concomitant influx of human traffickers, those promising refugees passage across the sea for the unimaginable price of selling off everything they own. And while those of us in the West have been aware of and horrified by the images of overcrowded boats capsizing during the journey and hundreds at a time dying at sea, a recent clampdown by the Libyan Coast Guard has inflicted a new horror on the already suffering migrants: enslavement. Smugglers, unable to turn a profit by transporting these humans seeking a better life, have turned into masters. And the migrants and refugees, these humans, have turned into slaves. Escaped or freed slaves, only emancipated after a hefty ransom from their families, say that these auctions are taking place in at least 9 locations across Libya. Though emancipated, former slaves still bear the scars, both literally and figuratively, of surviving such an atrocity.
Merciless beating. If you look at most of the people here, if you check their body, you see the mark, they're beating with electric, even your boot, or they took something like a sharp object. Understand? Most of them lost their life there. I was there, the person who came to buy me gave the man money. They take me home. So the money was not even much.
Since this footage was released last week by CNN, Libyan officials have denounced these slave markets, launching a formal investigation into the practice. And a horrified Rwanda is now offering refuge to these enslaved migrants. And while cracking down on the Libyan auctions themselves and taking in their victims are crucial steps in abolishing this abominable and antiquated practice, slavery remains a much more widespread problem than most of us realize. In 2016, an estimated 45.8 million people were enslaved around the world. According to the Global Slavery Index, the slave trade in some form exists in 167 countries, which is about 85% of all nations. And the U.S. is no exception. Last year, it was estimated that America, home of the free, is actually home to about 57,000 slaves. How? In 2017, are we still allowing humans, to be bought and sold like chattel? The number of people currently living in slavery is more than triple the total number of Africans kidnapped and sold into slavery between 1525 and 1866, and more than 10 times the number of slaves living in the U.S. in 1860. We are moving in the wrong direction, to the point where we are now condemning 45.8 million people to suffer one of the most unconscionable, abhorrent human rights abuses in the history of the human race. To combat the scourge of human slavery, governments need to take serious action. They need to ensure and protect the rights of all their citizens, and they need to provide basic necessities like food, water, and healthcare to prevent migrant and refugee crises in the first place. And in the meantime, they need to welcome and protect populations fleeing conflict and human rights abuses in their home countries. We cannot stand idly by while our brothers and
Bring
sisters
around the world... But we are standing by, and we are not going to do anything, and no one's going to do anything, because that's how far we have declined in human values and spiritual values. Do you really think the United States or anyone in an administrative position gives a damn about these people? No. I'll tell you what they do care about, very much care about, the oil concessions in Libya and making sure that the National Security Advisors had their people handpicked to replace Libya. These were terrorists, by the way. And when we say that Saudi Arabia is our partner and we need him to stop, we need them to help us stop terrorism, they're the world's largest supporters of terrorism. Now, the Washington Post can't find that story, and the New York Times can't, and NBC can't, and CNN can't. We can have documented with real journalists, not the clowns they hire. So what are your thoughts? I'd like to hear from you. Why can't we hold Barack Obama and his wife, who was also there and could have protested? She's not illiterate. She's highly educated. And, well, don't even mention Bill Clinton on any level. But Hillary Clinton, what does that say about the people who are willing, all the different feminist groups, all the other groups who are willing to support her, knowing full well these other actions that occurred around the world, and she was the architect of them? Your thoughts. While you're thinking about that, we're going to take a short clip, just as short because I'm going to get to my guest, on Brendan O'Neill.
Most of my time, you know, I came from the progressive world. I wanted to fix the left. Subsequently, 2 years later, after endlessly talking about this, I did a video with PragerU, which they titled Why I Left the Left, because I've come to the position that liberalism in the classical sense, the John Stuart Mill sense, no longer has anything to do with modern leftism.
Yeah.
So let's really go deep on this. So first off, let's start with why are you, let's start with the roots of why liberalism should be connected to the left. Let's just start there.
Well, the way I put it is that I didn't leave the left. The left left me because the left abandoned everything that it used to represent. And the way I see political correctness, which is this kind of rehabilitation of the racial imagination, so everyone is now black and white or man and woman, and this constant divisiveness and shoving people back into biological boxes from which they spent 200 years trying to escape. Or it's illiberalism, so it doesn't want you to be controversial or daring or contrarian. It wants everything to be sedate. Or even the modern PC people's agitation with things like economic growth or exploring nature, or even, dare I say it, exploiting nature for the good of mankind. On all
now
those...
That one can get you into
right,
extra trouble. Yeah.
I mean, that's super controversial.
Yeah.
All those things suggest to me that the PC culture, you know, people call it left. In my mind, it runs counter to everything the left used to stand for. I think it is reactionary. I think if anything, it's right-wing. I happen to think left and right aren't particularly useful categories now, but it's certainly more right-wing than it is left-wing.
Do you remember a moment when it happened? Because that's what a lot of people ask me. They ask me when my specific wake-up was or when your specific wake-up was, but do you think there was a cultural or political moment that really was the hammer that kind of whacked it and then started to go in the wrong way?
I think it's been a long-standing process. I think it's been growing for a long time. I think you could even trace it back to the 60s when the left shifts from being interested in economic issues and the working class towards being interested in, you know, the new left, interested in cultural issues and the problem of advertising and consumerism and so on. And that shift from being interested in production, how are things produced and who owns them, towards being obsessed with consumerism.
Mm-hmm.
Why are we always pressured to buy things and so on? And that was a very important shift from economy and power towards issues of culture.
Mm-hmm.
And then that grows through the 70s and the 80s and it becomes the dominant theme of the left. And you know, the way I see it is, if I look back, because I still call myself a Marxist libertarian, I partly do it just to...
We're going
to
unpack
I partly do it just to annoy people, because no one understands what it means.
Yeah.
Even I don't understand what it means. But I always considered the left to be universal, pro-growth, that was one of the most important parts of the left, and interested in autonomy, interested in pushing away all the priests and princes and bureaucrats who wanted to tell ordinary people how to live, and trusted ordinary people more than experts. That's how I saw the left. Now I see a left, a so-called left, that has abandoned those three things. So it's ditched universalism in favour of the rabbit hole of identity politics and the rabbit hole of biological difference or historical difference. It's ditched the argument for economic growth in favour of the cult of environmentalism and this idea that every single thing we do to the planet is destructive and maybe we should rein in growth and have less growth. And it's ditched the argument for autonomy and the shoving aside of the bureaucrats who want to govern ordinary people's lives in favour of sacralising expertise and celebrating the state and the role of the state in governing or assisting poor people who apparently can't cope on their own. So if those are the three spheres...
We're going to be bringing you more of him, Brendan O'Neill. You can agree or disagree in part or whole, but it's important that we hear what he has to say, and all people who would otherwise not have a voice in the media because they're considered off to the sides and therefore no longer value in anything they have to share. I think I would rather hear someone and disagree with them and share my disagreement or agree with them than not provide them with a forum. That's censorship. Now let's go over and say hello to my next guest who's standing by. He is Professor Paul Beckwith. I gave you his background earlier. Nice to have you with us today, Paul.
It's great to be here.
I'd like to begin with deconstructing the most recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that forecasts 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in 12 years, and this threshold would put the planet into an irreversible condition. However, I would like you to address this. The IPCC is renowned for being overly conservative in their estimations. My understanding is that they rely more on mathematical modeling instead of actual on-the-ground measurements in their forecast. You and Guy McPherson and about 15 others that we know who are climatologists or environmentalists specializing in the field have been warning about the short time period we have before runaway climate change for years now. Now, finally, the international community is slowly assessing their earlier conclusions and becoming more aligned with your predictions. So you were there at the beginning and honest. You did not consider whether or not people would be afraid or frightened in any way. Instead, you just wanted them to have the facts. And these people don't want to frighten anyone. So speak about why the IPCC report is still too conservative, and then share a little about the politics behind the IPCC or the reasons why their science is consistently shown to be inaccurate and underplays the severity of how bad it actually is. The forum is yours.
Okay, well, the first key point about this report is for the baseline temperature, it uses the average temperature between 1850 and 1900. And it says that right now we're 1 degree Celsius above that baseline temperature. Now, the problem is that when the original IPCC reports came out, they used a baseline. They called it pre-industrial, and it was 1750, with the year 1750. The temperature then, that was the baseline. And it's on that baseline that they started discussing the 2 degree Celsius stop band or guard band, if you like, for a safe climate. And it was only in Paris when they lowered that number to 1.5. But now that they've shifted the baseline, this is a key point because the temperature difference between 1750 and the new baseline, 1850 to 1900, is from 0.2 to 0.3 degrees Celsius. So that means that right now, we're 1.2 or 1.3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial, and 1.5 is the safe limit, and 2 is the original guard band. So we're already very much closer than the report pertains. Now, they've just glossed over this. I mean, they've shifted this baseline, I guess. You know, who knows? I mean, but that's the facts. That's what's happened. Now, how long will it take before we reach that baseline? it's hard to say because everything's accelerating in climate change. Everything is moving faster than expected. You know, we're getting exponential changes, but at the moment, the global temperature is rising about 0.25 degrees Celsius per decade. And if we're at 1.2 or 1.3, then obviously we reach that 1.5 in just over a decade. And if you add another, to add the additional 0.5 to bring us up to 2, you could add another 2 decades. If we're changing 0.25 degrees Celsius per decade, then 2 decades is 0.5. So we're much closer than the report indicates. That's the first point. The second point is that the IPCC over relies on models. So they simulate they have the climate system. They simulate what will happen going out into the future. They test these models looking back into the past, etc. But the problem is these models rely on they can only rely on things that are known, and generally they take a gradualist approach, if you like. They take an iterative approach that changes will be varying in a systematic sort of manner, not necessarily just linear, but in you can fit it to some curve. And the problem is that there's numerous feedbacks in the climate system, some of which we've already crossed, that are jolting the temperature up. It's lurching up in an episodic fashion, in a highly nonlinear fashion, and that is not accounted for or modeled. So we're in a much worse situation than the report states.
Thank you. I read that there were characteristics to this recent Hurricane Michael that caught weather scientists off guard, particularly the speed of the storm. The victims of these superstorms living in the Carolinas, Florida, and Georgia, Mississippi, and Alabama, if they remain in climate change denialism, will perhaps consider these extreme hurricanes as flukes, simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Now the towns and cities affected will be spending millions of dollars, hundreds of millions with the larger ones, to rebuild, and people will believe their lives will return to normal. And very few, including the state's legislatures and governors, will consider the likelihood that the days of normal have ended. It's over. Game over.
Including
all of Florida. We need to adapt to the abnormal now.
Yes. The problem is that the ingredients for these superstorms are very common now in the climate system. I mean, the key with the hurricanes is very, very warm sea surface temperatures, a lack of shear in the atmosphere, shear winds, which are winds going in different directions that tend to break apart storms. And the guidance of these storms, which is the jet streams, have changed completely. So, I mean, look at Harvey, Hurricane Harvey, last year. It came ashore and it just, meandered around, for days and days and days, dumping up to 5 feet of rain, in Texas. And then, of course, we had, Hurricane Maria and Hurricane, Irma. I mean, Irma was coming, was heading directly for Miami and Palm Beach, the east coast of Florida. And it was only in the last 24 hours or 12 hours that it veered from that route and came ashore on the west coast of Florida in the Everglades. If it had come up if it had maintained its path from 12 hours, you know, it's a matter of like last minute sort of changes, it would have come up and hit Miami and Palm Beach and raised the east coast of Florida. And people estimate it might have cost $1 trillion in damages, which would have just devastated the whole state. So, and of course, we had Hurricane Maria wipe out Puerto Rico. And, this year, of course, I mean, the thing with people were all talking a lot about Florence, right? Hurricane Florence coming up. And, it sort of acted similarly to Hurricane Harvey over Texas in that, you know, it was very slowly moving across, the Carolinas, and because it dumped so much rain on the Carolinas, that rain on hot ground would then evaporate, and then that energy would go and feed back into the storm. So it would stay alive over land a lot more than it would normally than a normal situation. And then, of course, this latest, the latest storm, Michael, it caught people completely by surprise. Not meteorologists, but the public, because it formed just south of the Gulf of Mexico, and in the Caribbean area. And it sort of meandered across the Gulf. Like it went basically from a tropical storm with very, very little rotation energy to a category 3, category 4 within a matter of days, and just crossed the Gulf. It didn't travel very far, right? It just formed and then traveled across the Gulf and then caused these tremendous damages that we've seen. So these storms are behaving very, very differently. Extreme weather events like this are happening more frequently. Not necessarily the hurricanes, right? The hurricanes we're getting are much larger and more powerful, and they're also hitting regions where they never hit before. For example, the one that Leslie, I believe it was, which meandered for 21 days in the Atlantic and then came into Portugal recently, just as a tropical storm, not as a Category 1. I mean, it just got downgraded at the last minute from being a hurricane, but it had huge impacts, and this is unheard of. We've never seen storms hitting like this in these locations that we're getting. And Ottawa, of course, we had our tornadoes in Ottawa. We had an EF3 and an EF2 hitting Ottawa and crossing the river. The EF3 crossed the river and affected the town of Gatineau in Quebec. Tornadoes are valley.
Yes.
In the U.S., they're getting a lot fewer tornadoes now, and we're getting a lot more tornadoes further north. So when Ottawa on September 21st, when Ottawa had the EF3 and EF2, there were actually 6 tornadoes in total that day, 3 of them in northern Quebec and 3 of them in Ontario. Then a week later from September 21st, a week after that, Detroit had 3 tornadoes that actually impacted the city. And just the week after that, after Detroit, so just a couple weeks ago, there was something like 21 tornado warnings in Pennsylvania. And of those, I think there were 13 or 14 tornadoes in that region. Now, this is very, very strange behavior, and what is it's resulting because for tornadoes, you need a number of different things happening. You have to get these supercell storms, which are rotating storms, and in order to have these storms, you need a clash of very warm, humid air with very cold air. And because of the temperatures that we've been getting, I mean, and I don't know about other areas, but Ottawa, for example, a few days last week, it was like 28 degrees Celsius, which is very, very warm with very, very high humidity. And when that air collides with cold air, like when the jet streams bend and are very wavy and extending far north and far south, then you get this clash of very cold, dry air with very warm humid air, and that generates the huge energy for these storms. And then if the jet streams are in that location, you can start getting the rotation and you start getting these tornadoes. So Tornado Alley is basically moving northward to the northern states and also up into Canada. So we're getting huge changes, just huge changes across the board.
Paul, we only have time for one last question for you. I believe that we are not going to slow down, mitigate, prevent global warming because it's intimately tied to our consumption society. Now, some people could say that's a capitalist society, but I can show you in China and India and other societies, they're consuming at a massive scale. They have more money, they have more education, and now they want what Americans have. So our capitalist system of constant growth, increasing the gross domestic product by consuming more means we have to use more. We have a finite planet. We're using up all of its resources and not caring about what we leave in its place. The new president of this neo-fascist who's being elected, probably the next president of Brazil, has vowed that he's going to, you know, rip out the lungs of the planet, the Amazon, to get that, to get the wood out and also to sell that, and the soybeans genetically engineered for the cattle. Doesn't care about the consequences. So since a capitalist society does not ever care about the consequences of how it makes its money, and since the people only care about what they're consuming and don't care about anything else, and other people don't consider what they're consuming, they only consider how they feel, you have a formula for complete neglect. So I just want you to answer one question. Give us your most accurate, honest guesstimate of how bad it's going to get and what would be the likely consequences and where. Is Paul there? Ah, he got disconnected. Okay, well, he didn't have a chance to... Oh, you're back. Okay, sorry, had a disconnect.
Yeah, the line got cut off there. Sorry.
Okay, did you hear my question?
I got you up until the Brazilian election and the wood and the soybeans and stuff.
So what is your best prediction, instead of the 12-year time limit that we're now being told, what do you see as a more realistic timeline, and where are people most likely to suffer the consequences?
Okay, so we have to look at the Arctic. Okay, so the Arctic sea ice is in dire straits. It's not forming properly this winter. It's extremely thin. It's likely to be gone for the first time. And a lot of people, including myself, call it the Blue Ocean Event. I think I started using that phrase years ago. But it's basically going to be gone come September, say by 2022. That type of time frame. And then within a year or two, it'll be gone for August, September, October, and within a few more years, July, August, September, October, November, and probably gone year-round within a decade after that. And then we're in a completely different world because the center of cold in the Arctic will be the center of Greenland, not near the North Pole, and that will have profound implications to the jet streams, which will be even more fractured and broken and weaker because they need the cold in the Arctic, contrasting the warmth in the equator to exist. So we're going to have a big impact on we're going to have trouble growing food to supply the existing population. So we're going to have global food shortages, and it will be, you know, we need to declare a global climate change emergency. And even if we stop all fossil fuel emissions, because the CO2 lasts in the atmosphere for so long, we're still going to have the warming occurring. So we need to remove, slashing fossil fuels is not sufficient. We need to actively remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And in order to buy us time to stop the temperature shooting up, we need to also figure out how to cool the Arctic to keep the sea ice and snow cover up there so that we have some semblance of jet streams and some, and can try to get some stability back to the climate.
So Paul, your answer is we got to start with a national worldwide emergency now, not wait for 12 years.
Okay. Exactly. Yes.
So I wanted to know. Thank you very much, Paul Beckwith. We appreciate all your concern.
You're very welcome. And if people don't know, I do all kinds of videos on this. So just Google Paul Beckwith Climate Science, and you can find all kinds of stuff that I'm talking about now in videos,
all the best,
et cetera. Okay, thank you.
I look forward to another conversation. We're out of time, everyone. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day.